in the history of post-war intelligence operations, no service has ever intentionally harmed an officer of an opposing service. It is not done. It would create havoc. Zhuganov swiveled. Volodya, relax. If we wanted to try the rough stuff, I'd be talking to Line F, not you, said Igorov, laughing. Korchnoi saw Zhuganov's right eyelid twitch. No, what I want is an elegant operation, nuanced, brilliant, that will produce quick results and will leave the main enemy wondering what hit them, wondering how they lost their sensitive asset, and marveling at the SVR's skill and cunning. Marbles Sirniki Pancakes. Thoroughly blend soft goat cheese, eggs, sugar, salt, and flour into a sticky dough. Refrigerate. Drop small balls of the dough into flour, coat well, and flatten into thin discs. Fry in melted butter over medium heat until golden. Serve with sour cream, caviar, smoked fish, or jam. Chapter 30. Korchnoi and Dominika were standing in the tiny living room of the general's apartment. The old man contemplated her unsettling beauty and noted how smoothly she moved, how she walked with her back straight, how her eyes locked on his. The more time he spent with her, the more he was convinced that he had chosen correctly. Now he had to enlist her. Tonight would be tricky. Outwardly, she was unemotional, controlled, focused. But in her interactions, her gestures, even in her deference to him, Korchnoi saw her anger and determination. She had never spoken about Sparrow's School, but Korchnoi had quietly found out most of the facts, just as he had done regarding her interrogation at Lefortovo. She was hiding something, he knew. She daily declared herself eager to engage again with the American. But the timbre of her voice, the tilt of her head, made Korchnoi suspect that Dominika's contact with Nathaniel in Helsinki had created conflicts, sympathies, perhaps feelings for him. He would soon find out. They had started work on the Nash Project, as he called it. In his darkened office with the shades drawn, the general had clicked a remote and images of Nate were projected on the white wall of his office. Out of the corner of his eye, Korchnoi saw Dominika draw in a breath. From the side, he could see her nostril flare. He went on remorselessly, minutely describing what the SVR knew about Nash, reviewing her own reports from Helsinki, watching her, weighing her inner reserves. He had turned off the projector and looked at her sternly. This was more complicated than the previous mission in Helsinki, he told her. Dominika must travel outside Russia, and in order to make her foreign trips plausible, she would be reassigned to the SVR Courier Service in Directorate OT. She had to operate alone, in the West. She had to get close to and seduce the young American, identify the Krisa, the rat. Could she still do that? Her dark eyes flashed, wavered, emotion, conflict. It was a serious challenge for Dominika to look at Nate's image on the screen. Had the general sensed her agitation? How long could she continue to fool him? Could he tell? That evening, Korchnoi invited Dominika to his apartment. He would prepare a simple supper, a decidedly un-Russian pasta dish, in celebration of their upcoming Rome trip, and they would continue discussing the operation. There was no hint of anything improper. General Korchnoi was a distinguished senior officer, a veteran spy, not a Grubich Chelovek, a cad. They rode the metro, got off in the 4th District, and walked along a broad, leafy park beside the Moskva River. Korchnoi's apartment building was the third in a line of 5 identical buildings, tubular high-rises in a row, streaked like candy canes from the rusting window frames. His apartment was on the 12th floor. The dingy elevator groaned loudly as it carried them up. The small apartment was spare but clean and comfortable, the living space of a person who lived alone but who didn't mind. There were a few treasures, an exquisite little framed Italian oil on the wall, a silk Persian carpet on the floor. These hinted at a career of foreign travel. In the corner were a well-worn easy chair, a reading lamp, and a low bookcase with a few bound volumes. The small room had a sweeping view of the oxbow curve of the river. Dominika saw a framed picture of a woman and a very young-looking Korchnoi standing in front of a lake. It was summer, and his arm was around her waist. "That was in 1973," said Korchnoi. "One of the Italian lakes. Maggiore, I think." "Is this your wife?" asked Dominika. "She's very beautiful." 26 years of marriage," he said, taking the frame from Dominika and tilting it toward the fading daylight to look at it. "We traveled together around the world. Italy, Malaysia, Morocco, New York." He put the frame back down on the table. "Then she became ill, misdiagnosed for months." They walked into the tiny kitchen. "Don't get sick at a Russian embassy overseas." He smiled. Dominika noticed his head was bowed. The general said he had moved into his apartment after his wife's death. He couldn't go back to their original apartment. He had traded it for this smaller one, relatively modern, relatively quiet, not too far out of town. He could enjoy the swath of green along the river. He didn't tell Dominika that burst transmissions aimed out of the 12th-story living room window had exceptionally fine line of sight to the American satellite. He poured 2 amber glasses of sweet Moldovan wine. The kitchen had a sink, a small refrigerator that rattled when the door was open, and a 3-burner cooktop on the counter. Dominika leaned against the counter and solemnly toasted to the successful outcome of their operation. The general was at ease, she saw. He radiated a warm purple glow that came from the depths of him. In her short time in Korchnoi's department, Dominika had grown truly fond of him. Apart from his obvious technical brilliance and his uncanny instincts, he had treated her with respect and even kindness, as if he was sorry for what she had endured up until now. And there was his loyalty to her. At a meeting in the department, Korchnoi had defended and endorsed Dominika's comment about an operation, actually stood up for her. "Where have you been all my life?" she thought, reminded again of her father. The double game she was playing would wound him if it came out, might even hasten the end of his career. Would he understand her motives? As he prepared supper, Korchnoi asked Dominika about herself, her family. Outside the discipline and protocol of the office, she spoke freely, affectionately about her parents, about her study of ballet, about her delight in discovering the West. Helsinki had been a marvel to her. She wanted to travel around the world. Talking like this to him almost made her forget how she was lying to him. She stuffed the thought under the rug. "And yet something happened to you in Helsinki," said Korchnoi, busy at the kitchen counter. "Can you tell me about it?" She hesitated, gathering her thoughts while she watched him dice tomatoes, garlic, and onions and sauté them in a pan of hot olive oil. "Udovietlino, remarkable. He knows Italian cooking," she thought. The kitchen was instantly filled with the aroma. "The American volunteer I helped handle," she said, draining her glass, "was arrested minutes after passing the document. The resident was the only other person who knew about the meeting. They could not understand how it happened. They naturally suspected the worst, that I had leaked the information to the Americans." Korchnoi poured her another glass of wine. "But they concluded in the end that it wasn't me," she said simply, ending it, not wanting to talk about it anymore, not wanting to keep lying to him. "Yes, but I meant something else happened to you in Helsinki," said Korchnoi slowly. "I read your reports. Despite somewhat regular contacts with Nash, there was very little actual progress with him." Dominika heard the tone in his voice, considered his choice of words. "Be careful," she thought. "He's just started working." "Yes, that's right," said Dominika evenly. "He was uninterested, avoided sustained contact. It was a struggle to get him to come out." Could he hear the lie? "It's strange, a woman with your beauty, and a young man, attractive, single, an intelligence officer living in a foreign country." Korchnoi let the thought trail off. The tomato sauce was bubbling. Dominika watched as the general poured a splash of balsamic vinegar into the pan, stirred, and began tearing pieces of basil into the sauce. His halo was growing brighter. She was silent, watching Korchnoi's hands pluck the leaves from the stem. He looked up at her. Neither Benford nor Nate had told him the CIA had recruited her in Finland, but he knew it was the answer. "Let's tip over the goblet," he thought. "You have been exceptionally lucky up to this point, my dear," said Korchnoi softly. "Even now, with the Soviet Union long gone, the Chudovishtya, the monster, is right beneath the surface." Dominika felt real alarm. He was drawing her in. She could feel it. She hadn't been that clever with him after all. He suspected, no, this old Fokusnik, this conjurer, knew. If she lied, continued to show him disrespect, he could take her off the operation, kick her out of his department. If she put her life in his hands and admitted everything, why wouldn't he report her instantly? Lefortovo would be mild compared to what they would arrange for her then. "Defend yourself," she thought. "Protect yourself." "I know about the monster," she said loftily. "I slept in the basement of Lefortovo. They forced me through State School 4, Sparrow School. I watched them murder a man with a wire. They almost sawed his head off. My friend Marta disappeared in Helsinki. They said she defected, but I know better." She realized that her voice was loud in the little kitchen. "She builds up quite a head of steam very quickly," thought Korchnoi. "A little more," he thought. "The young American Nash, did you like him?" he asked. "I suppose so," said Dominika. "He was funny and courteous and pleasant. I never knew Americans were like that." "My God, did I say courteous?" She thought she sounded idiotic. He was still looking at her, glowing purple, but with calmness. She felt like a bird, mesmerized, unable to move, watching the emerald green snake glide up the branch toward the nest. "I have the impression that you knew this young man rather better than you reported during your assignment in Helsinki," said Korchnoi. He paused and stirred the sauce slowly, the only sound in the kitchen. Korchnoi's voice was very soft. He would try it. "How did they recruit you?" he asked. Dominika was still. She looked across at him. She opened her mouth but couldn't speak. This was where the risk, the danger that defined her secret life culminated. This was much worse than resisting the brutes at Lefortovo. Her hands shook as she put down her wine glass. Korchnoi was stirring the sauce. The kitchen was filled with his expanding purple bubble. She could feel his overwhelming will. "Protect yourself. You are the only one who can save yourself. Leave. Get out of here." Then Korchnoi, the canny master, said a remarkable thing. "Dominika, I can see it. I'm giving you the opportunity to tell me, to trust me. I will not harm you." My God, what an interrogator he would make. But her intuition told her he was telling the truth. He would protect her. She wanted him to help her, to share her burden. She needed it. "I started out by following orders, trying to develop him just as he was developing me," she said, physically shaking. It was a race to see who would recruit the other first. She still resisted. She was still hanging on to the lip of the cliff. This was an invasion, not an admission. He wasn't going to let her slide. "Yes, of course," said Korchnoi, "but listen to me very carefully. I asked you how they recruited you." Dominika's voice was almost inaudible. She was sleepwalking. He raised an eyebrow, and she decided. She placed her beating heart in his hand. She stepped off into space. "They didn't recruit me. I chose to work with them. It was my decision. So I did, on my own terms." Korchnoi filled a pot with water from the sink, put it on a second burner, and threw a handful of salt into the water. He motioned her to come to the stove, handed her the spoon. Dominika stood over the sauce, stirring. "It wasn't a matter of love at all," she said in a small voice. "It was my choice." Korchnoi did not reply, but she knew she was safe. She was soaring over the cliff now, the wind roaring around her, the sea below exploding against the rocks, and she was flying. She knew she was safe with him. Korchnoi was satisfied. He did not view her admission as weakness or folly or stupidity. He saw how she had calculated, how she had assessed his intentions, but most important, how she had accepted mortal risk based on her extraordinary intuition. A formidable combination. Her admission also demonstrated her trust in him. That was important. She would need to trust him in the near future. Now it was he who had to take a chance. In 14 years, he had never slipped. But they had to be partners if this succession strategy was going to work. Telling her would be as difficult for him as it just was for her. They stood shoulder to shoulder at the little cooking element, the gas hissing through the burners, the sauce simmering in the pan. The wooden spoon made a soft sound, almost a musical note, against the thin aluminum as Dominika pushed the thickening tomatoes around. She turned her face toward Korchnoi. Up close, her beauty was matchless, but she didn't use it. "What do we do now?" she asked quietly. "Are you going to report me?" She wanted him to say it, to declare it. "I shall report you if you overcook the pasta," said the general, twisting a fistful of dry bucatini so it fell into the boiling water in a fan pattern. "And watch the sauce doesn't burn on the bottom. I'm taking off my coat and tie." He started down the little hall to his bedroom, then stopped and turned to her. "Now." "Perhaps you're wondering," he said. "My grief can't bring her back, but since my wife died, I have not believed in the cause. My heart was hardened toward them forever. I did my work, but I never again became one of them. They did not earn my loyalty, nor do they deserve yours now. They warrant our contempt." It was done. He stood looking at her. Her eyes were wide. Her agile mind grasped the implication before he finished loosening the knot of his necktie. She spoke in a whisper. "It's you. You are the one they're looking for. You're the..." Korchnoi put a finger to his lips to silence her. "Mind the sauce. Keep stirring," he said, turning down the hallway, leaving Dominika staring after his gray head and purple mantle. We assess the potential for success as good, the operational risk as minimal, said General Korchnoi. "We are ready to initiate in Rome. I am familiar with the city."
"Go on," said Vanya.
They were seated on the couch in his office. Zhuganov was in a chair to one side. "Corporal Igorova will approach the American CIA chief in Rome. We know the address of his residence in Centro Storico. We will choose a sleepy Sunday afternoon when everyone is glued to the game on the telly. Corporal Igorova will explain she is an SVR courier with only a few days in Rome. She has run a fearful risk by coming to him. She wants to contact Mr. Nash, Nathaniel, whom she knew in Scandinavia. The COS will know what to do. He will call, and Nash will be on the next plane to Rome."
"And once Nash arrives?" asked Igorov.
"It is likely that they will meet in Nash's hotel room," said Korchnoi. "Standard procedure. She will tell him she has been transferred to the courier service and that she will be making regular trips to Europe, Asia, South America. The Americans, of course, will be interested in her access. The possibility of intercepting an SVR pouch will excite them. With this cover legend, we can dictate the frequency and duration of future contacts. Corporal Igorova will then rekindle the relationship that was started in Helsinki."
"Very good," said Igorov.
"I will remain behind the scenes," said Korchnoi, "providing guidance as required."
"I expect positive results," said Vanya.
"May I make a suggestion to my operational colleagues?" said Zhuganov. "Why not have Nash come to Corporal Igorova's hotel room? More control, more secure." Korchnoi wondered why the dwarf would suggest this.
"A small detail at this stage," said Vanya, waving his hand. "Concentrate on positive results."
"Of course," said Zhuganov, deferring to his chief. He turned to Korchnoi. "You will, of course, keep Yasenyevo advised of your status, the meetings, locations." Korchnoi nodded pleasantly. Of course. I will report regularly, security and tradecraft permitting. Thank you, said Zhuganov. Korchnoi and Dominika walked down a corridor in headquarters. They each knew the other's secret now. It was unspoken, but each glance between them now was more knowing, the bond like leg irons, unbreakable and perhaps a bit uncomfortable. She walked beside him steadily, a little hitch in her walk, but really she was flying. She would see Rome for the first time, would see Nate again. Dominika sensed the general's agitation. He was unsettled and nervous. She looked over at him as they waited at the elevator. What is it? Now their every interaction was significant, every question touched the towering secret they shared. Something is not right. We must take great care on our little Roman holiday, he said to her. From now on you must do exactly as I say. Lika bidia nachala. Trouble is the beginning of disaster. The elevator doors opened and closed, as if swallowing them whole. In his own office, Zhuganov was on the phone. The walls of the smallish room were covered with photographs of Zhuganov and SVR colleagues, at the seashore in front of a dacha, standing together in a delegation. Most were gone now, purged by his own hand, he was tickled to note. He nodded his head and said, da, da, into the phone as if receiving detailed instructions. Yes, sir, it is clear. I know exactly what must be done. Yes, sir. He cradled the phone and keyed the intercom. Summon Mattarin. He is to come immediately. Prosterevo rechasservi navestrech, thought Zhuganov, sitting down behind his desk. Speak of the Grey One. The Grey One heads your way. Marble's Rustic Tomato Sauce. Sauté diced onions, sliced garlic, and anchovy fillets in olive oil until aromatics are soft and fillets have melted in the pan. Add tomato paste in center of pan and fry, stirring until rust-colored. Add chopped ripe tomatoes, crushed dried oregano, peperoncino, and a chiffonade of fresh basil leaves. Season to taste. Reduce sauce until thick. Add a splash of balsamic vinegar to finish. Garnish with fresh, torn basil leaves and serve over pasta or meatballs. Chapter 31. Officers in the Washington Residentura brewed tea, read newspapers, watched CNN and RTR Planeta, and occasionally peeked through window blinds last raised in 1990. Cable traffic, both incoming and outgoing, was down. Lunch dates came and went, appointments were missed, new contacts were going cold. The consecutive weeks of FBI vehicular and foot surveillance had been unprecedented, crushing, stifling. After the first month, the center had directed a stand-down of all operational activity until further notice, and requested the Residentura prepare a security assessment to explain the situation. There were no explanations. Even the elegant resident Golov was not immune. He confirmed trailing vehicular surveillance on him personally 20 of the last 30 nights, and he desperately needed to get black. The backup meeting with Swan was approaching, and he could not miss her a second time. There was no telling how she would react. Those 10 nights that neither Golov nor his Zeta counter-surveillance team were able to detect even the remotest hint of coverage were perversely the worst nights. The nights of not knowing, of not being totally certain. Did the Americans have some new technique, some new technology? The devil knew what their strategy was. But he had to get black. Everything must be done to protect Swan, but she was a security nightmare. She continued to refuse all reasonable proposals to improve her security, electronic communication, messaging, discreet hotel meets, prearranged alternates to cover missed meetings. She wouldn't have any of it. If I have my ass at the meeting, she had said to Golov, you can damn well have your ass there too. Impossible, woman. Golov yearned to turn Swan over to a low-profile illegals officer, but Moscow forbade it, especially after the compromise of the illegal in New London. Golov, therefore, was confronted by one of the most classic of espionage conundrums. having to meet a sensitive asset on a predetermined night at a predetermined site, regardless of conditions on the street. An abort was unacceptable, impossible. Tonight was the next scheduled meeting with Swan. He had to make it. That afternoon, he reviewed his surveillance detection route with the Zeta team. Golov told them he wanted to try to channel any trailing coverage into a stovepipe, to expose surveillance and, more important, to try a breakout, escaping surveillance altogether. They designated a code number on the encrypted radios that would signal whether the stovepipe had worked. They reviewed the route once again. Golov knew this was madness. Only an asset as valuable as Swan would make him take these risks. But the center was insistent. Golov had to try. He kicked off in mid-afternoon, the middle car in a simultaneous departure by eight of his officers and eight cars who exited the embassy gates on Wisconsin Avenue, each headed in a different direction. FBI watchers in the lookout post transmitted "Starburst, Starburst," a stampede departure designed to overload surveillance and get a few cars free. The Starburst callout was also heard by the CIA's Orion team. They were interested only in the resident, and they patiently listened for the watchers to call out Golov, who was driving his own vehicle, a gleaming black BMW 5 Series sedan. Golov headed up Wisconsin Avenue, his Zeta team already deployed to the west of Wisconsin. Golov crossed Western Avenue, the border between the district and Maryland, and turned south, reversing his course into the grid pattern of American University Park, using the neighborhood streets to drift sideways, reverse direction, pull up to the curb, and wait. After 15 minutes, the Zetas signaled. No apparent surveillance. They had missed two static Orion cars that had been in place on the margins of AU Park. Golov stair-stepped west again along residential streets while his team moved to parallel his route. They did not get the slightest whiff of the familiar swirling movement of active FBI surveillance because there was none. The Zeta team covered Golov as he pushed west downhill to Canal Road and crossed the chain bridge to Virginia. This was called by a static Orion car sitting on the intersection of Arizona and Canal Roads, the single route onto the only Potomac River crossing into Virginia between Georgetown and the Beltway. The Orions were tempted to flood suburban Virginia, but the team leader, a 65-year-old former surveillance instructor by the name of Kramer, told them to hold. He instead directed three cars to parallel Golov's directional axis on the Maryland side of the Potomac. They were going north along the river, anticipating the route. Trapdoor was in play. One Orion, a grandmother when she wasn't tracking SVR officers, held at the parking lot of Lock 10 on the CNO Canal National Park. Another grandmother drove 4 miles to the old Angler's Inn on MacArthur Boulevard, took a garden table in the waning light, ordered a sherry, and tried to guess which of the couples at the other tables were having affairs. Kramer directed a third Orion, this one a great aunt, another 4 miles north to the village of Potomac, where she ordered an early dinner salad at the Hunter's Inn. As the three women waited, they recorded a score of license plates and marked a dozen loitering people. The list of possibles grew. Were any of them waiting for the black BMW? The two remaining Orion cars, the team was small that day, separated. One covered the upper reaches of River Road southeast of Potomac, the other parked at the entrance of the CNO Canal National Park, where American traders like Walker and Ames and Pollard and Pelton over the years had pulled misshapen garbage bags of Russian money out of rotting tree trunks. The Orions all sat still and waited, keeping off the radios, their eyes scanning, checking, programmed to catch the profile, the gleam, the shape of the black BMW. If Golov continued into Virginia, they lost. If he headed back to Maryland but away from Potomac, they lost. They were content to wait. It was how Trapdoor worked. There would be other days and nights. All they had to do was be right once. As it turned out, they lost. Golov crossed back into Maryland on I-495. Part of a high-speed loop that enabled his Zeta team to begin setting up on the final leg of the route, The Dumahod, the stovepipe, the long, meandering beach drive which traced the gerrymandered Rock Creek Park in and out of the woods and creek bed south all the way to Georgetown. Hearing the distinctive squelch brakes designating all clear, Golov exited beach at the bottom of Rock Creek and parked on 22nd Street in the West End, leaving the Zeta team to continue south. If the FBI had managed to place a beacon on Golov's car, unlikely, it was never left unattended and was swept weekly, the feds would find it a block away from either the Ritz-Carlton or the Fairmont and about 50 restaurants along the K Street corridor. They would be welcome to check all those and more. He locked his car and walked 6 blocks to the familiar entrance of the Tabard Inn. It was dark now, and the interior of the inn was warmly lit. More madness to use the same meeting site twice in a row. At least there had been a cooling-off hiatus since the last rendezvous. Golov entered the inn and walked past the front desk, through the corridor to the little walled garden and back. This time, Swan had arrived before Golov. She sat at a table hard against the garden wall, smoking. Golov braced for trouble. Swan had just signaled the waiter for a replacement drink. An empty highball glass was on the table in front of her. She was dressed in a blue suit with a red blouse. A blue stone necklace at her throat matched the suit, and bright red nails matched her blouse. Her blonde hair was brushed back off her face, which in the diffused light of the bulbs in the trees seemed older and papery.
"Stephanie, how are you?" said Golov in greeting. He extended his hand, but she made no move to take it. He smiled at her and sat down. The waiter arrived with a double scotch for Senator Boucher. Golov, tired and stiff from nearly 5 hours in the car, ordered a Campari and soda. "Anatoly," said Boucher with mock warmth, "I have been waiting in this stupid little garden for nearly an hour." She stabbed at a little gold lighter several times before she could light her cigarette.
"I'm sorry about that, Stephanie," said Golov. "But I was preoccupied by the necessity of not bringing the entire Federal Bureau of Investigation with me to our rendezvous."
"How very professional of you."
"We could arrange things a lot more securely if you would consider just a few small changes," said Golov.
"Not this again. It's so very comforting to hear you talk about my security when there's a full-scale search in Washington for a highly placed Russian agent."
Boucher blew smoke into the air.
"Indeed. What have you heard?"
"We have no reason to believe your status is compromised," said Golov.
"We are quite certain that neither the FBI nor the CIA has any idea about our relationship. 5 people on this planet know who you are, and that list includes you and me. What is this about a search for a Russian agent? Details, Stephanie, please." This was important. Golov's scalp itched. A bad sign.
"I'm glad you're so confident. How, then, do you explain the closed-session briefing I attended, listening to one of those CIA idiots? It sounded like they have leads. They're looking for someone who suffers from shingles, you know, Anatoly, the painful red lesions on your skin, like the pain in my fanny."
She tilted her head back and finished her drink, the ice cubes clicking against her teeth. She signaled for another.
"Stephanie, you don't have shingles, do you?" asked Golov. He would have to transmit this information instantly, tonight.
She looked at him with irritation.
"That's not the point. You know as well as I that I cannot jeopardize my position. I've worked too long and hard to get where I am."
Golov marveled that her colossal ego could translate this deadly serious game as a potential derailment to her career. Did she know what dangers were involved? The consequences?
"This is exactly why I insist we begin meeting in hotel rooms."
"I'll consider it," said Boucher.
She appraised the waiter as he set her 3rd drink down, staring at him as he walked away.
"But now there's something else," she said in a flat tone, the one she used during congressional testimonies. "If you people make a mistake and the feds come knocking on my door, I will not go to prison. I won't go. So I want you to give me something permanent. Something I can take."
Golov sat back in his chair and marveled.
The mention of a mole hunt has unsettled her, and now she wants an L pill. A U.S. senator.
Where did she hear of this? He reached forward, held both of Boucher's hands lightly in his fingers, and spoke softly.
Stephanie, that is the most amazing thing I have heard you say. You cannot be serious. You're speaking of ancient history, of Cold War myths. There is no such thing.
I think you're lying to me, Anatoly, she said, smiling thinly as she twisted away from his hands. Either I get one, or I dissolve our partnership, as you call it. When we meet next month, you will be here next month on time. I expect a cute little pillbox. Make it ivory or mother of pearl.
I can still hardly believe it, said Golov. I will consult with Moscow, but I doubt they will grant authorization.
As was her custom, Senator Boucher waited until the end of their meeting before she dug into her purse and slid a black disc across the table toward Golov. Before putting it into his pocket, he saw the Pathfinder logo inscribed on the side. The senator certainly knew how to play for drama, Golov thought as he watched her walk unsteadily out. Shingles. Anatoly Golov sat in a New England-style rocking chair in a room at the Tabard Inn. The smallish room had florid purple walls, framed posters of French circus animals, was carpeted with a riotous Persian carpet, and featured an oversized four-poster bed in the corner of the room. Since his last meeting with Swan, there had been no abatement in surveillance on Residentura officers. Instead of risking another long SDR, Golov had received the center's approval to attempt a trunk escape to get black. On the morning of the meeting day, Golov had lain in the trunk of the car of the economic counselor, breathing pure oxygen from a small tank through a face mask. Three embassy wives drove, with absolutely no regard for surveillance, to Friendship Heights on Upper Wisconsin Avenue. Following instructions, the thick-waisted wives parked in the underground parking garage, locked the car, and went shopping. Another Russian spouse sitting in the garage watched the car for 15 minutes. There had been no surveillance, it was clean. Carrying shopping bags, the wife simply walked up to the car, tapped lightly twice, and unlocked the trunk to let a cramped and pissed-off Golov out. He cursed the Swan case and cursed Moscow and cursed the service, but he was black, undetected, surveillance-free. The trunk escape had worked. He left the garage and made his way south into the district by walking, getting on random buses and hailing an occasional taxi. He avoided the metro system with its ubiquitous cameras. He reached DuPont Circle and killed 2 hours in bookshops and in a little bistro. At sunset, at the height of rush hour, he walked around the circle, south down 19th, onto N Street, and 4 blocks to the Tabard Inn. No sign of surveillance. He had dressed casually for a change, to blend in on the street with a muted suede jacket over a brown crew neck, corduroy slacks, and suede walking shoes. Thank God for the good shoes. As he entered the inn, he slipped on a pair of heavy-framed eyeglasses with clear glass lenses. Golov sat in the hotel suite and finished a plate of Aegean clams that had been broiled with oregano, goat cheese, lemon, and oil, accompanied by a bottle of chilled Tuscan Vernaccia. He was relieved that he had rented the room using a forged U.S. driver's license and traveler's checks without a problem. It had been a number of years since Golov had rented a hotel room in Alias. That was a young man's game, and he had relived the tense, dry-mouth drill with cool enjoyment. Despite his foreign accent and the fact that he had no reservation and no luggage, the oblivious clerk behind the desk was satisfied. This was a distinguished gentleman. He was shown to the small but elegant room on the second floor where they would be out of the public eye. Privacy was paramount, especially tonight, with what he had to give her. He finished his supper, went into the bathroom to splash water on his face, look into the mirror, and again cursed the service. Locking his door, Golov descended to the small lobby and sat in a slightly musty green baize couch facing the front door. He waited, keyed up, an unread magazine in his lap. Senator Boucher walked into the place as if she owned it. She didn't see Golov sitting on the couch, the clear lens eyeglasses broke up his patrician features, and passed him within 2 feet. Boucher walked through a room to be seen, not to notice who else was there. Golov silently caught her in the corridor and steered her up the small staircase to the second floor. No one had seen them. Golov unlocked the door and let Boucher enter first. The senator looked around the room and smirked.
Anatoly, how cozy. I always suspected you were a romantic.
Ignoring the comment, Golov offered Swan a glass of wine, which she accepted in lieu of scotch.
Meeting indoors improves our security, Stephanie, said Golov. But we must choose another hotel for next time, I insist, and so does Moscow.
How very nice for you in Moscow, said Swan, holding out her glass for more wine.
Did you bring my vitamins?
Tell me you did, Anatoly, and I will be very happy.
Golov thought of an agent he once ran in East Beirut, a Maronite Christian who had gotten so accustomed to demanding money and gifts before sharing his information that the situation became impossible. Golov had directed a KGB Wimpel team to sink his weighted body off Rauche and the Pigeons Rocks past the 45-fathom line. He looked at Swan and daydreamed.
I have positive news, said Golov.
He poured another glass of wine and sat next to her on the small, velveteen couch. He took an oblong box out of his pocket and set it on the table. He opened the box to reveal an elegant pen nestled in a bed of powder blue silk. It was a Mont Blanc Etoile with a black hourglass barrel, flare creme-colored cap, and the iconic Mont Blanc inlaid white star at the tip. At the end of the pocket clip was a perfect Akoya pearl. Boucher reached for the pen, saying, How lovely. Golov gently stopped her by holding her wrist and pulling her hand back.
It's a beautiful pen, said Swan, but I asked for something I could take, a pill.
There are no pills, Golov said rather brusquely. We have consented to your quite remarkable request, and this is what we will give you.
He picked up the pen and gripped the pearl in his fingertips. You must grasp the pearl firmly, he said, and pull gently but steadily. The pearl suddenly came free. It was attached to the end of a 1-inch needle that slid out of a channel on the underside of the pocket clip. The needle had a burnt coppery hue to it, as if it had been held over a flame. Golov slid the needle back into its sheath in the clip and firmly pushed the pearl past a detent into the locked position.
What is this? Said Boucher. I asked you for something simple.
Be silent, and I will explain, snapped Golov. He wildly fantasized about extracting the needle again and plunging it into Swan's neck. He composed himself. The needle is coated with a natural compound. It requires only that you break the skin, scratch yourself anywhere, and it will take immediate effect. 10 seconds. He held up his hand to silence her. This is infinitely more effective than a pill. Please forget what you have seen in the movies. A pill can lose potency after a period of time. There is no problem with this. He handed Boucher the pen. Now you extract the needle, he said, once again putting his hand on her wrist. Very slowly and carefully. Boucher's hands shook a little when she took the pen, hefted it in her hand, and pulled the pearl slowly and evenly, drawing it out of the clip. The little needle glinted dully, its menace somehow accentuated by its stubby length. Boucher carefully seated the needle back into the sheath and pushed the pearl home and locked. She turned to Golov a bit chastened.
Thank you, Anatoly.
She clipped the Mont Blanc inside her blouse between the buttons and threw back the last of her wine. The gravity of the moment now passed, her eyes wandered around the room and settled on the 4-poster bed, and then on Golov. Even remotely interested? She asked to his infinite horror. Golov's Mediterranean Clams. Mix fresh oregano, lemon juice, panko breadcrumbs, olive oil, and crumbled feta cheese with room temperature butter to form a smooth compound butter. Roll and chill. Put a round of the butter on each opened clam in its shell, resting on a bed of kosher salt. Broil until butter is melted, 1 to 2 minutes. Squeeze lemon juice over clams. Chapter 32. Rome was ochre roofs and lambent marble under the eternal sun. The bumblebee buzz of motorini hip-tilted through traffic by raven-haired girls in crocodile heels filled the air. General Korchnoi breathed it in. This was his old operational ground, and he remembered. He ordered lunch in rusty but elegant Italian. Domenica had never heard of spaghetti alla Bottarga, but a bowl of pasta glistening with oil and row of gray mullet transported her. She looked over at Korchnoi, who nodded, pleased. It was nothing like Russian caviar, she thought. They were sitting in La Taverna dei Fori Imperiali, two tiny rooms with cloth-covered tables and pastel murals on white stucco walls, floors of polished black and white tiles. The restaurant was halfway down Via Madonna dei Monti, a narrow, ancient street in the perpetual shadow of scuffed apartment buildings with ground-floor bakeries and wood shops, the air filled with the smells of baked bread and sawdust. Domenica had the day before approached the COS and delivered her message, leaving the number of her throwaway phone. Korchnoi carefully observed Domenica before and after the contact, rock solid and calm, and he approved. She was stimulated on the street, her cheeks were flushed, her wide eyes reflected the splash of a dozen dolphin fountains. Korchnoi unilaterally changed the ops plan once they were away from Moscow. He had quietly insisted that they would initially connect with the Americans discreetly on the street and then use a CIA-rented room for conversation. "Forgive me, but I do not trust your uncle or that Zhukanov," Korchnoi told Domenica now as they strolled after lunch. They walked slowly past the forum over the San Pietrini cobblestones and up a narrow walkway, looking for trailing coverage. They put a euro into a tin box and descended into the Mamertine prison, imagining St. Peter being lowered into the dungeon through the hole hewn in the rock of the Capitoline Hill. The prison unsettled the Russians, and they left quickly, back up into the sunlight. As they walked, stair-stepping through neighborhoods, they used time over distance to ensure they weren't covered in ticks. Korchnoi talked to her, sometimes stopping her to put a hand on her shoulder. He described the life of working for the CIA from within Russia, undetected inside the service. They sat on a bench near an obelisk, spooning granitas, rich coffee ices, stealing looks at their watches and pedestrians and parked cars, and Korchnoi told her how a spy must know the difference between risk and recklessness, and about evaluating but not necessarily accepting the direction of your CIA handler. "It's your life, your welfare," Korchnoi said. "You ultimately decide what to do and how to do it." The Roman light freed her, and she told Korchnoi more about Helsinki, about her activities, about how she felt with her secret. "The sweet ice of it," she said, looking at the cone of frozen espresso in her hand. She spoke sparingly about Nate, for she did not know how he felt about her, or what she felt herself. Did he see her as an agent first, and a fleeting lover second? It was too hard, and Korchnoi saw it, knew it. The general spoke of restraint and calculation and patience, the trinity that enabled him to survive for 14 years as a CIA asset. It was unspoken that they would work together, but they did not try to define their partnership further. They knew agents seldom spied in tandem. Korchnoi did not speak at all about his vision of succession or of Dominika's role as heir apparent. What else they did not talk about, perhaps could not, was Russia and their sentiments about their country. This was boggy ground of betrayal and treason, and they left it alone. That would come later. Now they just had enough time to finish the SDR and make it to the brief encounter site and meet the main enemy. Marble had informed Langley via satellite burst that Dominica's approach to COS Rome would signal their arrival in the city. That would trigger a meeting in 24 hours, ironically, at a long inactive KGB site in the Villa Borghese that Marble remembered from 15 years ago. He had also transmitted a brief sentence. "She passed. She's ours now." Indicating to Benford that Dominica had, in essence, been re-recruited by him. A most extraordinary situation. Two agents, each witting of the other, a single handler, the whole case directed by a mad scientist of a CI chief, two mole hunts, and the added necessity of having to decide where to eat dinner. This was Rome, after all, Marble thought. Dominica's cheap little phone trilled as they walked up a staircase to the northern limit of the Aurelian walls, catching glimpses of blue-green trees and the biscuit-colored tiles and the golden domes. Korchnoi answered in Italian and listened for 10 seconds, then abruptly clacked the phone shut.
They're in place. Would you like to take a stroll through the park?
They walked in the heat of the Roman afternoon, through the Porta Pinciana and into the Villa Borghese. Korchnoi wore a light gray suit with a dark shirt open at the neck, Dominica a navy skirt and a pink and blue striped shirt. She wore her hair up against the heat. Together they looked like father and daughter, prosperous Romans walking, perhaps, to visit the museum in the center of the park. Korchnoi could see she was excited and nervous, her blue eyes flashing, but he also saw her darting glances, checking for surveillance, cataloging casuals. Of course Korchnoi knew the park. He had been assigned to the Rome Residentura as a junior. He had met agents there, had left packages for assets and buried caches, his young wife watching for him. A lifetime ago. Now he and Dominica walked down the broad gravel avenues dappled by sunlight filtering through the plain trees. Korchnoi led Dominica past reflecting pools and paused at the perfect Fontana dei Cavalli Marini, with the rampant seahorses with cloven hooves. They walked around the hippodrome of the Piazza di Siena and down the Viale del Lago. Korchnoi had seen no repeats, no indication of coverage, despite their serpentine route. 2 minutes to the site. He felt, rather than saw, that Dominica was becoming nervous, was tightening up. Korchnoi slipped his arm around hers and told her a joke. A frightened man came to the KGB. "My talking parrot disappeared," he said. "This is not our case," says the KGB. "Go to the criminal police." "Excuse me," says the man. "Of course I know I have to go to the criminal police. I am here just to tell you, officially, that I disagree with that parrot." Dominica snorted, then covered her nose with her hand. Korchnoi watched her and knew his instincts had been correct. She would be his replacement. She could do it. Benford would realize it after 10 minutes with her. They were nearing a small artificial lake with the classical Ionian temple to Aesculapius on an island in the middle. She followed Korchnoi's gaze and saw a short, rumpled man sitting on a bench at the edge of the lake. "Benford," said Korchnoi. "I will greet him." He nodded his head in the direction of the island. "Keep walking around the lake," he told her. "There is a footbridge connecting the island with the shore." He walked to the bench. Dominica saw the man get up, shake hands with Korchnoi. They sat down. Dominica began walking around the small lake on legs she could not feel. Her heart was pounding. She could hear herself swallow. What would she say to him? That she missed him? "Gluppi." "Stupid, stay professional. It's not just the two of you here. There are others present, and this is the first day of the rest of your life as a spy. Stay professional." Beneath a willow at the shoreline, she saw a dark figure standing on the little steel bridge at the top of its graceful curve. She knew his form, how he held himself, leaning against the railing, a silhouette in shadow. She could see the halo around his head, darker than she remembered, but that may have been the shadow of the tree. He was moving now, his footsteps echoing on the steel bridge. Blossoms from the willow floated on the still water. She walked up to him, offered her hand. "Hello," she said. She stood still, waiting for the bubble to pop, for him to ignore the handshake and wrap his arms around her. "Dominica," Nate said. "How are you?" He extended his hand and she shook it, feeling his grip, remembering everything. "We were worried about you. It's been a long time not knowing." Purple and glowing like she remembered. She let go of his hand. "I'm fine," she said. "I've been working with the general." That at least was now out in the open, the secret she had been searching for. He did not want to talk about marble with her, for the rules of compartmentation made it difficult for him. He had replayed what he would say to her when they met, how he had thought about her every day, how much she meant to him. But it came out wrong. "I'm glad you're out," he said. "We have a lot to talk about." He heard his donkey words, the words of a mid-grade agent handler. Before long, he would be reviewing the agent meeting sched with her. Dominique could see him struggling. His halo was pulsing, as if slave to his heartbeat. They looked at each other wordlessly, and Dominique tensed because she knew she would put her arms around his neck if he didn't move first in about 3 seconds. They heard a soft click of fingers snapping gently, and Nate's head came up. Benford waved. He and Korchnoi were now standing. Benford pointed and started walking. Nate waved the assent, then walked after the two men, Dominique at his side. The four of them sat in the elegant sitting room of Benford's suite at the Aldrovandi Hotel, on the opposite side of the park. Muted earth tones, a vase of flowers, a dazzling white marble floor. Turquoise swimming pool in the garden below, behind a screen of cypress pines. The breeze through the open balcony door blew the white sheer curtains in gentle spirals. The bottle of wine stood unopened in a copper bucket on the counter. They sat in chairs around the coffee table, the curtains lifting and falling. Benford had discussed, was still discussing, the unique situation of Marble and Dominica. "It's unconscionable," said Benford. "The worst security possible. We're going to have to make adjustments immediately."
"Excellent idea," said Marble. "I would like to speak with you about this very subject, Benford, privately. I fear it would be best, for the moment at least, if Dominica were not in the room. And while I appreciate that Nathaniel is responsible for me as my case officer, I am sure he would not mind instead going with Dominica to keep her company."
The two left the room, and Marble turned to Benford, who was lighting a cigarette. "She is young and passionate, but she is smart," said Marble. "Ever since I placed her in my department, she has been looking at me, not speaking, assessing me. I could see her resolve. I made her admit her recruitment in Helsinki herself. I suspected as much. Were you ever going to tell me?" Benford shrugged. "And I told her about myself obliquely, but she picked it up instantly. We've been talking about risk, danger, work, about penetrating the center. She listens, not a blink, not a tremor. Quite satisfactory," said Marble.
"That's most reassuring," said Benford dryly. "I still think that as a junior woman in your service, she will have challenges in her career. It will be years before she attains any important position, if ever."
"You know the game as well as I, Benford," said Marble. "The ones who start small and grow into the role are the best, the most secure. She is perfect."
"And will she be able to turn you in? Can she?"
"She will if she does not realize what she is doing. It will make her performance all the more convincing. Her shock will be genuine. In any case, she will follow instructions. I am sure she will."
"This is preposterous," said Benford. "We need you now more than ever. To contemplate losing you before time..."
He stubbed a cigarette out in a crystal ashtray. Marble shook his head. "We cannot calculate time. I have no way of knowing how close they are to getting me. Vanya is active, apart from the Kanareshka Zapadnya."
"Translation, please," said Benford.
"The canary trap he is running. God knows what else he and Zhuganov are hatching."
"The point?" said Benford.
"The point is that I may have much time or little. It's critical that Dominica be prepared as soon as possible. If they catch me before she turns me in, the profit is lost."
"Pardon my French, but shit," said Benford.
"Stop complaining, my friend. We are doing something unheard of in our game. We trade, what, a year or two of my information in exchange for positioning a new spy with the potential for working in place for 20-25 years. It's inspired."
Benford shook his head. "This is not what you worked for all these years, with the danger and the risk. You deserve retirement, rewards.
My reward will be to leave things in place to continue this work through her. It remains for us, you and I, to choose the right